Well, good morning, TNC family, on a great Sunday morning, where we are going to laugh and learn and grow and connect with God together. So let's pray and dive in. Oh God, in the heavens, not far away, but all around us, may your presence and wisdom come to bear now in our lives, right here on earth as in the heavens. May we receive exactly what we need to live lives of greater love and forgiveness, peace and purpose, goodness and joy, for the increase of your kingdom and power and glory forever. Amen. Well, we're in a series during which we're following Jesus during the last days of his life on this earth, and entering into the stories of some interactions he had with people, encounters with surprising twists and turns, interactions that led to changes in the thinking and behavior of everyone who experienced them. And not just them, these stories, preserved, retold, written down, remembered, and considered, have literally changed the course of humanity over the last 2,000 years. They've been the inspiration and bedrock for faith and thought and action. They have inspired scientific and social revolutions, new ways to see the divine, and better ways to respect and serve and share this planet with fellow human beings. And so there's no reason why that can't happen today, to you and to me, through today's text, if we will allow God's Spirit to speak through it. And I hope that's the case and the main purpose of you listening here, to put the wisdom of the scriptures into practice. Because as we'll see, when folks met Jesus and actually started embracing and putting into practice his teachings, his understandings of life, what they discovered was new life, new peace, new purpose, new hope. And our series is called Who really? ? Because these stories ushered in surprises to the established way of thinking and acting. They asked and answered unexpected questions. And today's story is from John chapter 9, and the question is, who really is blind? Who really is blind? Verse 1, as Jesus was going along, he saw a man who had been blind from birth. Teacher, Jesus' disciples asked him, whose sin was it that caused this man to be born blind? Did he sin or did his parents? And they asked because there was a dominant paradigm of human reality in that day, that everything happens for a divine reason, and therefore there is a connection between present disability and previous moral disobedience, present problem and divine punishment. But what we're about to see is Jesus opposes this analysis of how the world is ordered. Yes, good things happen as a result of good actions, and bad things happen through bad actions, but it's also true that bad things happen to good people, and good things happen to bad people. And so we have to stop thinking of the world as a kind of moral slot machine where people put in a good act coin and get a particular result, or a bad coin and get a bad result. Whose sin was it, the disciples ask, that caused this man to be born blind? Did he sin or did his parents? Verse 3. He didn't sin, replied Jesus, nor did his parents. And Jesus goes on to perform a miraculous deed, healing the man of his blindness and creating a real dilemma for the establishment, because either this man is a sinner, but now he's not getting his justice, or this man is not a sinner after all, so must have been blind for another reason, or Jesus is divine, which is the last thing they want to acknowledge, because if they acknowledge his divine authority here, then they have to acknowledge all of his new ideas. First shall be last, greatest shall be least, forgiveness, servanthood, generosity, women's rights, Jews and Gentiles the same. Verse 16 says, quote, "And so the people were divided." Which is almost always the way it is, friends, when paradigm-changing ideas or discoveries or events come about. People get divided. Verse 18, the Judeans didn't believe that he had really been blind and now could see. So they called the parents of the newly sighted man and put the question to them. "Is this man really your son?" they ask. "The one you say was born blind? How is it that he can now see?" Verse 20, "Well," replied his parents, "we know that he is indeed our son and that he was born blind, but we don't know how it is that he can now see, and we don't know who it was that opened his eyes. Ask our son. He's grown up. He can speak for himself." Notice TNC, the man's parents, too, also aren't really sure how best to deal with this. So the Pharisees, for a second time, they call the man who had been blind. Verse 26, "Tell us again what he did to you," they ask. "How did he open your eyes?" "I told you already," replied the man, "and you didn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again?" Verse 28, "You're just saying that because you're his disciple," they scoffed. "But we are Moses' disciples. We know that God spoke to Moses, but we don't know where this man comes from." Verse 30, "Well, here's the thing," replied the man. "You don't know where he's from, but he did open my eyes. And we know that God doesn't listen to sinners, but if anyone is devout and does his will, God listens to them." The man is actually saying, "So I must be devout." Verse 32, the man goes on, "And if this man wasn't from God, he couldn't be doing things like this." I.e., this man is from God. So it's not just this healing that needs our acknowledgement. It's everything Jesus is saying and doing. Verse 34, "You were born in sin from tip to toe," they replied, "and you're going to start teaching us, start lecturing us?" And they threw him out of the synagogue. Kick him out of the church. Are you with me? The disciples are confused about what to do with this new situation. The Pharisees are defensive and afraid. And even the parents feel overwhelmed and concerned about this new reality. Because new information, new light is coming into the culture. And it leads to disequilibrium and a confrontation between old established truth and new possibilities, new ways to understand God's movement and wisdom for the culture. By the way, notice verse 5, Jesus says, "I am the light of the world." In other words, Jesus from the get-go of this story is making this story not just about one man's sight, but about the entire culture's sight, light of the world. And look at verse 39. Jesus says, quote, "I came into the world for judgment so that those who can't see would see and so that those who can see would become blind." In other words, this man is not blind anymore, but now you are. Who really is blind? Answer: anyone who can't be happy for the man's sight. Who really is blind? Answer: those who refuse to consider a new paradigm for living. Who really is blind? Answer: those who don't want to put, in the words of Jesus in Mark chapter 2, new wine into new wineskins, who try to sew a fresh patch onto an old garment. And I think this story is a significant challenge for those of us in our era who admire and want to follow the way of Jesus in our lives, but who are reluctant to consider that God is still doing new things in our culture. But in fact, God is always doing new things, things that call us out of our comfort zones and into new eras of faith and trust. Which means it is possible, it is possible that I am the one who is blind. I am the one called to see the new light. Now, I am fascinated with why it is so hard for the Pharisees and the disciples and for the man's own parents to see this new light. And by extension, why it is that we sometimes struggle to embrace new paradigms, new light, new information in our culture. Why? Well, I want to suggest to you three reasons why. Because I believe the people in Jesus' day have three blind spots, three things they're blind to that make it hard to see the new things Jesus is doing. Three blind spots that we too would be wise to pay attention to in our day. So let's talk about these three blind spots. Here we go. Number one, they are blind to their biases. They are blind to their biases. Let me explain. One of the most fun books I've read in the last couple years is the international bestseller called The Art of Thinking Clearly by Rolf Dobelli, founder of Zurich Minds, a community of some of the world's most famous and distinguished thinkers, scientists, artists, entrepreneurs. And in the book, there are 99 chapters, each chapter introducing a bias or illusion that often prevents folks from thinking clearly. And I think you see some of these biases at work in John chapter 9, where the man is healed. As the people struggle to come to terms with facts that don't fit their worldview. And then with accepting these new facts and what they might mean. And they struggle, I think, not because they're bad people, but because they have biases that create blind spots when new light comes to them. And let me mention just three biases. The first bias is one that you're actually likely familiar with and have come across. It's called the confirmation bias, in which we interpret what we see in light of what we already believe. Which is why the religious person sees walking away from a horrible car accident as being God's protection. But the atheist says, you just got lucky that the impact point was to the right of the steering wheel. Which is why a beach sunset confirms for the mystic that God exists and loves beauty. But the same sunset for the scientist only confirms that gravity bends light across a 78% nitrogen atmosphere, filtering out certain wavelengths. Which is why if the high school boy already thinks she likes me, then her smile in the cafeteria line confirms, aha, she must want me to sit next to her at lunch. In the words of Rolf Dobelli, our beliefs are often based on paying attention to the information that upholds them while turning a blind eye to information that contradicts them. And let me use a popular news story of our week to make this point. If we think there is likely racial bias within the royal family in England, then we immediately agree with the information shared by Meghan Markle. But if we think that racial bias is overplayed in our culture, then we look for hints or clues that she and Prince Harry are making things up. Confirmation bias. We don't like somebody's policies, and so instead of seeing the good in them, we look for one misstep, confirming we are right. We don't like somebody's theology, and so we try to find one hole, confirming they are misguided. We think somebody is just out for our money. And so when they offer that add-on, it confirms that they're just trying to upsell us. And in the John 9 story, the Pharisees see, well, the parents are not 100% certain, and the man himself is now trying to lecture us, but I know I'm smarter than him about the Torah. And all of that just confirms, which is why Pharisees in Jesus' day hear the man's testimony, but interpret the new information in a way that's compatible with their established beliefs and convictions. Confirmation bias. The second possible bias in the text is what DeBelly calls the sunk cost fallacy. And let me explain. Have you ever been reading a book or watching a movie or TV series and thought, this is not good at all. I should just turn this off. But then you think, no way, I'm not throwing in the towel now. I've already watched the first 4 episodes. I'll at least finish the first season. Or if you're watching a movie you paid for, I'm not going to turn it off right now. I'll be throwing away the $9 I spent to stream this thing. And yet, the money's already gone. You've already spent the money, no matter if you finish watching it or not. It's already what is called a sunk cost. Or imagine you're sitting in a meeting at work where the company advertising campaign that has been running for 6 months is failing miserably by every metric. And so you raise your hand and you suggest scrapping it, to which the advertising manager pushes back, says, no. We've invested so much money in it. If we stop now, it'll have all been for nothing. Sunk cost fallacy. And this happens with investors and their stocks. This happened in America during the Vietnam War. We extended our involvement because the thinking was, we've already sacrificed so much for this war. It'd be a mistake to give up now. Okay, TNC, let me get more personal. Maybe you have a friend who has struggled for a long time in a bad relationship. Her boyfriend has cheated on her more than once, and each time he came back truly sad and sorry, and so your friend tells you, you know, I've just invested so much energy in the relationship, it would be wrong to throw it away. Sunk cost fallacy. Or maybe you've thought one way about economic policy, or climate change, or public education, like for a long time. And so you feel like you have to stick with that way of thinking. Sunk cost fallacy. Or in the theological realm. Well, I've always read the King James Version, and I don't care that it was written before the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and earlier, more reliable texts. I'm sticking with it. I've always believed that hell is a real place, burning forever and ever, so I will not consider any new, better biblical scholarship on the topic. And my point is, I just think it's possible that the Pharisees in Jesus' day hear the man's testimony, hear Jesus' new vision for life, but have a blind spot when it comes to changing their theology or ways of doing life or ways of seeing things. Well, my philosophy has got me this far. I'm not going to change now. Sunk cost fallacy. Now, the third possible bias creating a blind spot in this text is what DeBelly calls the sour grapes bias, in which he retells the famous fable first told by the Greek thinker Aesop about the fox who crept up to the vine and stared longingly at the plump purple overripe grapes. And so the fox places his front paws against the trunk of the vine and stretches his neck and tries to get to the fruit, but the fruit is too high. So the fox tries jumping, but his jaw only snaps at the air. So the fox gets a running start and jumps, but still no grapes in his mouth. But some pain from a hard fall to the ground. So finally, the fox turns up his nose and walks away into the forest, saying, "The grapes probably weren't even ripe yet. Why would I want sour grapes? Sour grapes. I won't admit that my skills are insufficient. So I will interpret what happened as your problem, not mine. I lost out on getting that job to another candidate, not because the other person is better suited, but because, man, that employer must be ignorant. Besides, I didn't really want the job anyway. I lost not because it was a fair and square game, but because the referees made bad calls or the system was rigged. Sour grapes bias." And did you notice in the text, John chapter 9, the Pharisees are like, there's just no way that new light about God would come to her first, to him first, to that group and not me. It would always come through me first. I'm a synagogue guy. No way they got the grapes and I don't. So I won't accept it. Sour grapes bias. And biases always create blind spots. We all have them, TNC, although they are hard to acknowledge, because doing so almost always puts our sacred beliefs in jeopardy, or causes us to think that, man, if I change my mind, it's a mark of moral weakness or admitting defeat. And so Jesus comes and says, "I am the light of the world, and I offer a new way to see God and a new way to treat other humans and a better way to see reality, but they're blinded by their biases." Now, there's no easy anecdote to our biases, friends, but here's a place to start, I think. Start by spending time in bias-busting environments. Bias-busting environments. You know, if you mostly hang out with people of your same ethnicity or economic status or gender, then hang out with those who are different from you and watch your biases get busted. If you mostly read from conservative websites and authors, read from some liberal ones, and vice versa. If you mostly watch one network, watch another for a time. If you have yet to become a faithful giver, start setting aside 5%, 10%, 15% of your income and giving it away each month. And see if your fears on the front end melt away. Because biases create blind spots, and so we must confront our own if we want to see the new light. Okay. Another blind spot, number two. First one is that the Pharisees' disciples, they're blind to their biases. Second thing that might be causing their blindness to Jesus' light is this. It's the curse of knowledge. The curse of knowledge. Let me explain. Most of you know that for the past almost 20 years, I've taught piano lessons to children and adults 2 evenings a week. But here's something I don't think I've ever shared with you. Do you know when the most dangerous time is for a student? The time during which progress is most likely to slow down? It's usually in year 2, after they know the basics already. Because unfortunately, as they gain experience, their confidence climbs faster than their competence. And they are more resistant to coaching and challenge and correction. They take pride in their progress, which is a good thing, but which can promote a false sense of mastery, which is a bad thing. And they get trapped in beginner's mode. Which, by the way, is a well-recognized phenomenon in our culture, sometimes called the armchair quarterback syndrome, where sports fans are convinced they know more than the coaches on the sidelines, which is why we yell at the TV set so much during games, because we know more. But friends, you likely don't know as much as you think you do about what play to call, about what they should do, about that issue, about that area of expertise, that philosophy. The curse of knowledge is that if you think you know something, it's harder to look for gaps and flaws in your knowledge, let alone to fill or correct them. But one or two self-help books does not make you an expert. As my friend says, it makes you dangerous. Which, by the way, think about it, self-help books are actually an ironic category, since the very act of buying a self-help book is an admission that we must ask somebody else for assistance. There's an author and a TED Talk speaker, a guy named Tim Urban, and he describes this curse of knowledge this way. It's arrogant. And arrogance, he says, is ignorance plus conviction. Theologian Peter Enns just calls it the sin of certainty, which is exactly what the Pharisees suffer from in Jesus' story. When Jesus heals the blind man, I mean, why don't they just say, wow, I think I might have to reconsider my paradigm here. Maybe doubts some of my previous knowledge and skills are in order. Maybe I should ask better questions or absorb some of these new ideas. But they don't. It's the curse of knowledge. So, here's a suggestion for you and for me. Make a list of areas where you are ignorant to help combat the curse of knowledge. Write them down. I've written down just a few of mine. Mine include art, financial markets, fashion, chemistry, engineering, home renovations, medicine, law, what it's like to be discriminated against on a daily basis, what it's like to worry about where your next meal will come from, or if the water you're drinking is clean or not. I'm ignorant to why British accents turn American in songs, why people say they slept like a baby when babies wake up every 2 hours. I'm ignorant to why Pluto still isn't a planet. And to quote best-selling author and Wharton's top-rated professor, a guy named Adam Grant, in his amazing new book called Think Again, quote, "The single most important driver of success is how often you update your beliefs. A process of becoming less wrong than before. Great thinkers," he says, "maintain doubts because they know we're all partially blind and they're committed to improving their sight. They don't boast about how much they know. They marvel at how little they understand." And I just think, what if the Pharisees had said, wow, this is new information. This is new stuff. I need to learn. But instead, they get trapped by the curse of knowledge and say, well, I'm already pretty knowledgeable about this area. And it blinds them to the new light. Which brings us to the final blind spot, which could be blocking the Pharisees, the disciples, the parents, and you and me from seeing new divine light in our era. I'm saying if you might be like, I don't hear God, sense God, can't figure out what God's doing in my era, then maybe you're blind because of your biases. Maybe you're blind because of the curse of the knowledge you already have. And number three, they are blind to the joy of being wrong. That's right, they're blind to the joy of being wrong. And I'm just going to be very brief here. Being wrong is not a bad thing. It's a sign that we've learned something new and that discovery can actually bring us to light. Further, think about it, friends. There's really no benefit to you for being wrong for longer. It's much better if I change my belief sooner because I will benefit faster. And you've heard the stories of inventors and scientists and entrepreneurs and theologians who have advanced our culture in the best of ways. And almost to a fault, it's that they find joy in amending their preconceptions. One of the most famous psychologists of the last 50 years, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, coined the term cognitive flexibility, which came from studying Linus Pauling and Jonas Salk and concluding that what differentiated them from their peers was their cognitive flexibility, a fancy word for humility about what they didn't know and joy in discovering new truth. And so we need to come to find joy in being wrong, friends, something the Pharisees couldn't do. And so they were blinded to the new life and the light that Jesus offered. Now, I want to end with this. I really believe that the way of Jesus still offers sight and light and healing and hope for our era. And I believe we're standing in an era where there remains a new wine of gospel possibility. But it will require that you and I confront biases and confess the curse of our knowledge and embrace the joy of being wrong. It will require a willingness to let go of old ways of thinking, old ways of holding on to settled church orthodoxy, old mantras, old practices of privilege. It will require a willingness to let God speak new truth through surprising voices, including perhaps the likes of a blind sinner. Because in Jesus is always an invitation and a summons to see more clearly, to love more dearly, and to follow more nearly. Let's pray. God, I pray today that John chapter 9 and verse 25 would become increasingly true of us. Quote, "One thing I know, though I was blind, now I see." God, I pray that you would help us see more clearly your light for our relationships in the home, your light for our relationships at work, in the community, in the city, in the country, and our world. I pray that you would help us in this era to speak gently and to listen humbly and to serve joyfully. And I thank you for speaking to us in our era through this great story of old. Amen.